listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly conversation continues with Professor Tony Montero in what may be our first conversation about the 2020 elections. Well, Professor Montero, I looked up today, first of all, remembering about 2 years ago when we went to the RNC and the DNC, looked up the information about the one coming in 2020. Now, 2020, we should be able to see clearly, right? And sorry for that. And, you know, I guess we've got one is in July and the other in August. They're more than a month apart. The Republicans are in Charlotte, was it? It's in North Carolina, somewhere in one of those states. And the Democrats have, I think, still three cities that they're deciding among, including, was it St. Louis or some one of the smaller Midwestern cities that they've never had it before. So anyway, the drama for the whole 2020 thing is starting to stir in the background to everything else we're going to talk about, which includes Trump at the wall today or whatever at the border, the Pelosi-Schumer press conference following up after Trump's presser the other night, every other crazy thing going on in the world. Pick a place and we'll start there.
Well, the 2020 election has already begun, and it will take place within the midst of the greatest political crisis in almost 160 years, and probably maybe the greatest political crisis in the history of the country. This will be the most unusual election, at least in modern times. It has all of the aspects of not just a great drama, but the fracturing of the political system itself. And I believe one, if not both, of the major political parties will disintegrate right before our very eyes. And now, you know, the Democrats, with about 25 people having announced or getting ready to announce, will probably show the greatest fracturing of either party. And we see already these factions, the young guard, so-called socialists, so-called progressives, versus the old guard, the Pelosis and the Schumers, and those connected most securely to the big money donors of the Democratic Party. I see this as a fight to the death within the Democratic Party. I think for the most part, the Republicans will remain not the Republican Party, but really the Trump Party. And so that's where it's going to be fought. It's going to get nasty. It's going to get ugly. And we can't rule out, if not a major recession, at least a mild recession, which will increase the sense of insecurity and uncertainty among the working people of the United States. So I look forward to this. It's going to bring to the fore all of the great contradictions that affect a late capitalist society like our own. And the ripples from it, of course, will affect the politics in all of the major capitalist countries.
You know, when you talk about this election taking place in the midst of a crisis like that, of that 160-year magnitude, I just did a quick lookup of the 1860 and 1864 elections. And there's some very curious things here that people, I've forgotten some of this just looking at the skin of it. You know, there were four candidates in 1860 when Abraham Lincoln was elected.
Yeah.
And he was elected with only 39.8% of the popular vote. There were two Democratic candidates. Stephen Douglas was a Northern Democrat, and John Breckinridge was a Southern Democrat. And between the two of them, they got about 2.2 million popular votes to Lincoln's 1.865 million popular votes. But because of the nature of the Electoral College and the relative populations, Lincoln had 180 electoral votes, and between them, Breckinridge and Douglas only had 84. And Douglas had only 12 electoral votes, even though he had 1.38 million popular votes. And Breckinridge had 72 electoral votes as opposed to 12. And he had only 848,000. In other words, he had two-thirds of the popular vote that Douglas had, and he had six times the number of electors. So that was in 1860. Then 4 years later, in the midst of the Civil War, it's only two candidates because the South was seceded, and it was closer. George McClellan got 45% of the popular vote, and Lincoln 55%. This is, you know, with the Civil War raging. So, you know, it was pretty interesting stuff.
Oh yeah. And we're facing a crisis of that magnitude again, and elections take on strange dynamics in the midst of political crises. Well, I don't know if we can predict the outcome. What we can predict is an intense struggle. The question is, what role will the masses of people play? Will they sit on the sideline and just observe this through CNN and podcasts and MSNBC and Fox, or will there be active organizing, for example, for peace in the sense of actual withdrawal from Syria, actual withdrawal from Afghanistan? Will there be a demand, for example, to cease shipment of military equipment to Israel? Will there be a discussion of a comprehensive immigration policy? And really, will the question of infrastructure development and a jobs and anti-poverty program find its way into the debate? I am hoping that in this period, this year or so before the 2020 election, that people begin to organize and hold town halls and other kinds of meetings on a grassroots level, that the unions begin to discuss the issues that confront the working class. I think this could present an opportunity for the grassroots, both in the labor movement and in the communities, to make their voices heard and through their actions and discussions to determine the directions of this election.
You know, that's a very good point. I'm looking at the claim of, Russian hand directing, not just a little Russian influence in the 2016 mm-hmm. election, but mm-hmm. Russia determined who our president is. That's mm-hmm. Not even subtext of all of these Russiagate claims. Mm-hmm. But the fact pattern it rests on is, tens of thousands of dollars of Facebook ads and whatever. Which is, is laughable compared to a $2 billion electoral budget and all the airtime that everybody got that had nothing mm-hmm. to do with Russia. The day before yesterday, I saw an article in the Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, the same guy that owns Amazon, as we know. Mm-hmm. And it was a propaganda piece slandering China. The headline itself carried with it the implicit claim, I think the explicit claim, actually, that China has gulags for Muslims inside mm-hmm. China. And because I think that was the actual title of it, like China's Gulags for Muslims or something. So it occurred to me, now you look at the last week, the week before, Apple utters that they might not sell as many iPhones, and the Dow plummets like 600-700 points. People look at it like, oh my God, are the markets going to go into a free fall over mm-hmm. that? China, it occurred to me, and I posted something mischievously to my Facebook page about this, but it really started a conversation. I'm China, and Bezos is slandering me in the newspaper, clearly mm-hmm. attempting to meddle in my internal affairs in a way that is much more heavy-handed, and by the mm-hmm. way, with a much more heavy-handed tradition coming from the United States than mm-hmm. anything anybody could accuse anybody of inside doing to the United States. Mm-hmm. And that they're looking to establish a regime change with this propaganda. Well, mm-hmm. suppose, and now we have the Helms-Burton Act style mm-hmm. sanctions as a precedent now established mm-hmm. by the United States. If we wanted to throw an embargo around Cuba, not only do you have to stay away from Cuba, but you have to stay away from anybody that didn't stay away from Cuba, or you got to stay away from the whole world. Mm-hmm. Like, in other words, we can isolate you for doing business with somebody that does business with somebody we say you can't do business with. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking, okay, let's take those rules and even bring them in a generation closer to the vest. Let's say China decides, because Jeff Bezos is slandering us and looking in coordination with the U.S. to do regime change in our country, we're going to sanction Amazon. They cannot carry any product manufactured in China that's manufactured any place that's been financed by China, that is being sold and or wholesaled or transported or whatever by anybody that has anything to do with China, cannot sell to Amazon. Mm-hmm. Now, if this talk about the iPhones sent the markets into a dive because the sales were off by 10%, what would China saying and proving to the world, Amazon, you cannot sell any more Chinese goods or any goods that had any trade with China at all? That's like Amazon can't sell anything, in other words. It turns mm-hmm. into like a Soviet store in 1989 or something. mm-hmm. What do you think? Mm-hmm. What kind of power is that China could drop? You say you know, one of the influences on the election might be, you know, whatever is going on with the economy. Suppose China decided to drop that, like, in October of 2020, the kind of influence that they could have. And so when you're talking about the unrest in the country, you suddenly have a prospect of an inside-outside game.
Yeah, but, you know, it's a dangerous game. And because China, even with the slowdown, is, if not now, will in the next year or two, be the largest economy in the world.
Yep.
The global economy will, in large measure, be dependent upon what happens in China. I think that the ruling class of the United States is without a vision and are desperate. The internal struggle within the ruling class, and actually, I think the more intense one is between the ruling class and the people. This struggle has driven a good part of the American elite mad, crazy. And that is a factor. And so what we have to prevent or hope to avoid is their doing something desperate, like a military confrontation with China or Russia. It is not insignificant that based upon Trump's announcement of withdrawing the 2,000 troops from Syria and 7,000 from Afghanistan and all of the implications of those withdrawals, that Mattis was fired and General Zinni just resigned from his position as ambassador to Qatar. I think it's Qatar. So now we have not only the FBI, the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the other nine or so intelligence services of the United States in lockstep opposition to Trump, but increasingly the generals withdrawing from his administration and signing petitions or ads that say that he is making a mistake, that he's endangering American security, and on and on and on. These people are capable of doing desperate things in desperate times. And that is why the action of the people is so important. I would just put it that way. I hear what you're saying. There's hysteria from people like Bezos and probably others, but that's the situation that we face at this point. Right. They begin to act as though the political crisis is in fact, as I have suggested, an existential crisis of the political system.
Yeah. Here's another example of exactly that question in what has to be obvious meddling by the UK. This is the Guardian newspaper today. What is America going to do about its Trump problem in 2019? The subheading, removing Donald Trump is essential, but to fully address the work that needs to be done, his appointees must also step down. This is instructions from London, basically, to the American government. So it's going to be quite a pot being stirred.
Oh, no. I would not underestimate the critical nature of the situation that we're confronted with. You know, some people who have been generally progressive are making arguments that look like Bernie Sanders or Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, that the place that we must all go is to the Democratic Party, that the Democratic Party must hear the voices of its so-called left wing. I think that is a losing strategy from the beginning. What we need is independent political action of the people that forces anybody that enters this race to respond to the demands of the people for peace and justice and economic prosperity, which means a poverty infrastructure program, a green ecological New Deal, but at the core, there must be peace and the cut in the military budget significantly. So any other discussion, I think, leads nowhere. It constitutes a capitulation to the ruling class and really to the most warlike elements of the ruling class who are presenting themselves as candidates of the people while still holding tightly to their position of war and endless wars abroad.
Yeah. I mean, in a condition of disintegration, of delegitimization, of chaos, you have the hardest push, the most belligerent foreign policy that perhaps imaginable being unleashed. And actually, that's the weapon that they want to use to smash what remains of the constitutional government in the country. Donald Trump is not fit to be the president, despite the fact that he was elected, because he's an agent of Russia. And therefore, we can, and the Russians are basically trying to do away with our constitutional system. So in order to protect ourselves against that, we have to disregard our constitutional system and remove Trump by any means necessary.
That's right. That's right. And this is the worst form of McCarthyism and Cold War propaganda. I mean, it is, it harkens back to the worst days of the 1950s. And for so-called liberals and progressives and even leftists to join that type of parade is, in fact, heresy, apostasy. It is a betrayal of all that they say they are supposed to be about. Now, that means that this period that we're entering into is going to have to also be contain an ideological and political struggle within the left and progressive forces. And the truth must prevail. There cannot be this hiding behind the Democrats should do X, Y, and Z. Well, let's be real. The Democrats are not going to do anything but what they have done in the past. It remains the party of the neocons and the neoliberals, more so now than in 2016. I mean, let's get it real. It is the party of war. And all of the generals, all of the deep state operatives that abandoned the Republicans and Trump are now in the Democratic Party. That's the big tent.
And I remember the, was it the 2012 election? When they, in essence, announced the death of the Republican Party. It might have even been first in 2008 because the Democrats had recaptured both houses of Congress, and then Obama was elected president. And they retained or expanded for the first, for the year 2008, the majorities in the House and Senate. Now you have people writing about Trump was able to find a path to the White House through the remains of the Republican Party, the debris of it, and that, in other words, that this condition did exist, the Republican Party was finished, and, you know, out of the ashes comes Donald Trump. Well, you know, they're saying the same thing about the Democratic Party now, and they seem hell-bent on, you know, as they mobilize, you know, the most right-wing reactionary forces and express them through the Democratic Party, what one thing that they're doing is creating the same kind of condition that the Republicans did when they had the most, you know, backwards, you know, right-wing Christian maniacs spewing in 2012, that some new voice that actually talks some sense might get the support of the constituency. What do you see in terms of that?
Well, see, I think it's hard to compare 2012 to 2020 or even 2016. Yeah. I mean, we're in the throes of a crisis the likes of which has not been seen in this country for almost 160 years. I mean, and that is the backdrop to everything. Now, of course, at the same time, the global economy is slowing down. How deep the recession that is coming will be, no one can fully predict. I know one thing, the stock markets are very jittery. That can tell you something about how the financial oligarchs and elites look upon the future. But that having been said, the deepest crisis is in the political system. And when you look at polling about people's attitudes towards the press, towards the Congress, towards almost every major institution of the country, they show very low approval ratings by the people. I mean, in the 20s and below. That is what we call, and I've said this before, a legitimation crisis. And it is made even worse by the fact that the center has collapsed. The vital center has collapsed. And people like Richard Haass of the Foreign, the Council on Foreign Relations is now talking about how to manage the dismemberment of the American empire, how to manage it. And if he's talking about it here, you know, in Germany and France and England and throughout Europe, elites are also discussing that as well. And perhaps the crisis is worse in Europe because the single currency, the euro, might be abandoned by country after country. And if that happens, then you're looking at a whole new political and economic situation in Europe. The other side of it is, with all of the attacks upon Russia, with all of the sanctions upon Russia, Russia remains stable. And in a lot of ways, Putin and his government can show certain victories, especially in Syria. That is not insignificant. And that is what really bothers a lot of the U.S. elites. The other question is what happens in Ukraine, what and how will the Chinese-Russia strategic alliance go forward? And finally, I would say, what will happen on the Korean Peninsula? This is highly significant. I think the world is trending towards a new configuration where the United States will no longer be, and I think Trump is signaling this, will no longer seek hegemony. The multipolar world is being born out of the ruins of this unipolar world, a situation of 30 years. We don't know what will become of Europe as a whole, but we do know that things look better on the Asian continent than it does in Europe or North America.
Yeah, I mean, I think the competing visions, to use some sort of symbolic language, would be that the existing hegemonic drive and project, you know, would be that the United States is the king of the world, and Trump sees maybe the United States being like the boss of all bosses. You know, like first among equal, you know, something like that. In other words, more it's a more of a collegial, form of domination.
Well, one would hope so. One would hope so.
Well, it seems like that's a multipolarity. In other words, that would be the symbolic representation of multipolarity as opposed to the hegemony.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So that now you have like that struggle that's driving a lot of this. That's mm-hmm. the foundation of a lot of this. You have, the intense contradictions just generally in terms of the crisis of legitimacy that you talk about, the continuing austerity, the hollowing out mm-hmm. of things. You have a contradiction also shaping up or becoming remanifest maybe between the real economy and the mm-hmm. financialized economy, mm-hmm. where you might see like the markets look terrible and maybe interest rates not be favorable, but people having jobs and things, and so the economy itself, being better for the people that are going to go vote. Like, yeah, interest rates are terrible, but I got a job and I just had a turkey, and so we're going to vote for you. Then that's kind of weird, but you've got things like the Atlantic, for example. Colleges are no match for American poverty. All of the things that people expected before are, like, mm-hmm. way out of reach now. Now, all of that mixes into to this.
Yeah, you have to include it all. You have to do a holistic analysis, as they in sociology says, a multivariate analysis.
Right.
you know, and there are so many factors that you literally do need computer programs to kind of predict outcomes based upon how you weigh the various factors, the political crisis versus the world economy, or how they, not versus, but how they interact. So, but then, you know, still, I am convinced that it is people who make history. And so much depends on what the masses of people do. It seems that Trump will be very, very difficult to beat in 2020. But of course, the struggle might be over holding on to the House and taking back the Senate. And then going forward with some form of impeachment if he wins, and maybe even a coup d'etat. And you cannot rule out a desperate act of warfare taken without Trump by forces in the military. You know, there's so much in, that could happen in a crisis like this. But the key is to educate the masses, to prepare the people for whatever comes, and to help them to see what's going on and then to organize in their class interest.
And that is always the trick, isn't it, Tony?
Yeah,
thank
that's
you
the
very
trick,
much.
Always.
I'll speak with you again next week. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Don.
And that was the world-renowned Du Boisian scholar from Philadelphia, Professor Anthony Montero. He's featured here weekly, and he came to us via Skype from Philadelphia Thursday. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo tells us America is a force for good in the Middle East. Well, that's pretty amazing. And online censoring continues apace. Also, are the Democrats the party of war now? Cross-talking some real news, I'm joined by my guests here in Moscow. Mark Sloboda, he's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Babich, he's a political analyst with Sputnik International. And in London, we cross to Marcus Papadopoulos. He's the editor of Politics First magazine. All right, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to Marcus in London. We have Mike Pompeo on his tour in the Middle East. He gave a wide-ranging, if very confusing, speech in Cairo. Essentially, he's blaming American foreign policy in the Middle East on Barack Obama, while at the same time talking about the same three issues, Iran, Iran, and Iran. What's your takeaway from the Secretary of State's tour?
Yes, I read the transcript of his speech, and I found it a most peculiar one. But I think I can partly explain it. I think that Mr. Pompeo is trying to reassure America's key allies in the Middle East, and of course they are Israel, Saudi Arabia, and to a lesser extent, Egypt, that America, despite having lost in its objective in Syria, is not walking away from the Middle East, is not a weakened force in the Middle East. Now, of course, there is a lot of truth to that, because as I said moments ago, the American objective in Syria has been defeated, and has been defeated in large measure because of Russia. But at the same time, since Mr. Trump became president, of course, America's ties to its two most crucial allies in the region, Israel and Saudi Arabia, have been enhanced greatly. Yeah. Let us not forget, Trump has now recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and of course Trump has signed defense contracts with Saudi Arabia to the tune of something like $500 billion or $600 billion. So yes, it's a strange speech, because we all know, or people on this planet at least know, that America is a great force for destruction and instability in the Middle East. But I think because the Americans have been defeated in Syria, they need to reassure their allies. And also, as you said, Peter, I do fear for Iran, because I believe with Trump in office, this represents an opportunity in a lifetime for those on Capitol Hill who want to overthrow the Iranian government. And perhaps something will happen under Trump's tenure in the White House.
Yeah, we'll talk about how the Democrats and the media reacted to the speech as well. Mark, what was your takeaway from the speech? Yeah. Because I agree with Marcus in London, is it so bad that Pompeo has to reassure people?
Yeah. First of all, without disagreeing with the substance, just a slight correction on the numbers. Trump has signed roughly around $300 billion worth of deals with Saudi Arabia.
But there's a lot of other deals in the pipeline from the past.
However, 90-some percent of those are actually Obama-era deals that were just re-signed. So
it's about $600 billion.
Yeah.
It's about $600 billion.
Yeah.
It's about $600 billion. But anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh. Pompeo opened up his speech with this little bit that I found very interesting. In my office, I keep a Bible open on my desk to remind me of God and his word to the truth. And then he said, it's the truth with a lowercase t that I'm here to talk about. And then he went on to say, America is a force for good in the Middle East. Now, there's nothing, of course, wrong with him having a Bible on his desk, but he's giving a speech in a Muslim-majority country to the Muslim world. And he opens this. I felt that he was an evangelist, that a tent revivalist. I half expected him to suddenly pull out a group of snakes and start twirling around in circles, yelling, America's a force for good! America is a force for good! As the snakes bit his head off, I guess. It was absolutely bizarre speech. Even across the Middle East, even among these supposed U.S. allies, and we're talking about the Gulf dictatorships here, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, UAE, Kuwait, they were embarrassed by this. They were offended and insulted by this speech. There's just so many weird statements in it.
I know.
When he said at one point that in World War II, American GIs were there to free North America, we assume you meant North Africa, from Nazi Germany. Would Russia and China come to your rescue? Russia and China, of course, fought in World War II, and it was Russia that defeated Nazi Germany in Berlin.
Well, so and also, Dima, interestingly enough, the American media doesn't like to talk about it. Certainly Mike Pompeo doesn't like to talk about it. But there is a peace process going on to finally resolve the issues in Syria, and it's being led by Russia. Mike Pompeo doesn't realize or doesn't want to recognize it. Go ahead.
Indeed, this process is pretty successful, because basically the Constitutional Commission is working. Most likely there will be negotiations in Geneva. The fighting in Syria is now much less than just a few months ago. And obviously you have Russia, Turkey, Iran working on one side, and you have Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the United States jealous.
It's very complicated. You could put Turkey in both camps simultaneously.
Talking about Pompeo's speech, it was strange. When I read some of the sentence from it, I thought, oh, Jesus, he's starting to say it now. When he said, our choices, the choices that we make, have consequences for other countries. I thought, Jesus, yes. He's going to talk about destroyed cities in Iraq. He's going to talk about Libya, about Syria. He's going to repent. Oh, no. The choices of not interfering is bad, according to Pompeo. Then he says, the results of Obama's misjudgments have been dire. I'm like, oh, yes. He made a mistake when he supported the insurgency in Syria. Pompeo is going to say, no. He did not support the rebellion in Iran. Jesus. So it was not enough for us. The war in Syria, the war in Iraq, the war in Libya. Pompeo wanted us to have a war in Iraq,
another
too.
Another takeaway from it is that Western meddling is good, it's moral, it's virtuous, but Russian meddling, alleged in the United States, is evil.
Yes.
Again, I find
and
it
not
very
enough
very,
Western meddling is also evil.
The thing is that I see this pattern over and over again, this lack of self-reflection, of actually looking at your own words here. Let me go back to Marcus in London and change gears a little bit here. Glenn Greenwald came out with an excellent article at The Intercept. As Democratic elites reunite with neocons, the party's voters are becoming far more militaristic and pro-war than Republicans. I never thought I would read a headline like that. Is an excellent article. I think our viewers should take a look at it. But we have a historical shift here. Or maybe we don't. Is it just out of spite because Trump has talked about during the campaign and during his presidency about withdrawing troops from Syria for sure, Afghanistan, rethinking possibility of American troops in Iraq? I mean, this is something that his base likes. Public opinion polls show it. But because Trump is for it, the Democrats and the liberal media are against it. What's going on here, Marcus?
Well, I don't think there's been any shift. And certainly in my lifetime, the Democrats have been as pro-war as the Republicans. Let's not forget, in the 1990s, how Bill Clinton, for example, facilitated the arrival of the Mujahideen to Bosnia during the civil war there, and the Mujahideen enacted some of the most appalling atrocities of the 20th century against Bosnian Serbs. Let's not forget how Bill Clinton gave the order for NATO to start bombing Serbia for 3 months. And Mark was talking earlier about how Pompeo was referring to the Bible. Well, at the beginning of 1999, Bill Clinton, Peter, was sitting in the Oval Office, and he asked God, shall I bomb Serbia? And guess what God said? Yes.
Yeah, I guess so, I guess it, just like George W. Bush was talking to God about Iraq.
That's what the other phone in the Oval Office is for. It's a straight line to God.
Yes, absolutely. So in my opinion, the Democrats and the Republicans, when it comes to foreign policy, they are two sides of the same coin. They have no respect for the United Nations Charter. They have no respect for international law. And I think, you know, the Democrats have proven their commitment to war over the last 20 years.
I want to go back, and we can take a look, our viewers can take a look at the article. The point is that polling data shows that the Democrats are more pro-war than Republicans, though I suppose, you know, it's to one degree or another, both are interventionist, both support American exceptionalism. Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, so the numbers show that as of right now, some 49 to 33%, the majority of Americans, support Trump's withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria. And the vast majority of that 33% is Democrats. And the almost identical, we see very similar numbers with the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Here's the problem. Just a few years ago, when it was Obama campaigning on withdrawing troops from Afghanistan, which he ran on and then actually surged troops into, Democrats were overwhelmingly supporting withdrawing all troops from Afghanistan, and Republicans were against it.
So explain, 40 seconds.
Partisanship.
How
does Trump play into this? Because Republican voters as a whole, you know, there's always specifics, support whatever Trump says. When Trump was launching airstrikes into Damascus on the pretext of chemical weapons, Republicans supported that. Right. So, but I think there is a long-term shift with the neocons gravitating to control both parties directly now. When we have woke Bill Kristol and Robert Kagan supporting Hillary Clinton and so on, and this may not be reversible. This may have a longer trend than partisanship.
So the neocon cancer on the Republican Party has just migrated to the Democrats.
Okay,
I'm going to jump in here, gentlemen. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go to Dima now. Let's change gears. We see online censorship gaining a pace here. We have this NewsGuard app that will basically tell the consumer of news sites what's truthful news, real news, as opposed to fake news. But if you look at these, the background of these people here, I mean, this is a combination of old media, traditional media, and deep state figures determining what news is all about. Is it trustworthy in your mind? Because if you, obviously, the New York Times is gets a passing grade, but of course, the television station that we're on right now doesn't.
Well, I mean, these people from the so-called heritage media, you know, legacy media, they have been exposed, even in the last 2 months. Just look at all of these stories. You know, the sound attack against the American diplomats in Cuba was actually produced by insects, right?
Crickets.
Crickets. In Ukraine, they supported the regime, which, surprise, surprise, added Stepan Bandera's birthday, you know, on the 1st of January. They made it a national celebration day. It's one of the most important anniversaries.
A Nazi collaborator.
Absolutely. Yeah. The head of the Ukrainian nationalists who destroyed tens of thousands of Jews in Kiev alone. And this was reported by the New York Times. The New York Times published an opinion piece by Eduard Dolinsky, the head of the Ukrainian Jewish Committee, who exposed it, but the newspaper and the regime in the United States continues to support Poroshenko, President Poroshenko of Ukraine and his regime. So they have been exposed so many times, but they continue to say that other guys are dangerous. The same story with France and Germany. In France, suddenly, there are more yellow vests, you know. This last Saturday, there were more yellow vests than at the previous one. Who is to blame? Russia. Russia, the same story with Germany. We hear calls in, first, Germany and France, they have also introduced very tough laws controlling the internet. The representatives of the alternative parties are the first victims in both France and Germany. And these guys, they just cannot admit that their ideology can be wrong. It's always Russia or, you know, Zuckerberg did not notice something. He let these Russians, he let these Venezuelans, he let these Iranians post their messages there. This is obviously a terrible crime.
Let me, Marcus, this is a continuing trend here that we saw with Alex Jones, which I'm not a big fan of, but I think that he should have a platform, and many, many others here. This seems like a second wave. This NewsGuard wants to basically monopolize the American market, presumably to be rolled out on a global scale. So this is going to be, 2019 is going to be another bad year for free speech. Go ahead, Marcus in London.
Well, let's approach this new app as a proper court of law would. And I have two questions to pose. Number one, who owns this app? What is their background? Or what are their backgrounds? And number two, who will decide what is trustworthy or not? Now, these are two critical questions which have to be addressed and have to be answered. But as we all know, Peter, for many, many years now, there has been a concerted campaign in both America and Britain to denigrate Russia and the Russian people, and to denigrate those commentators in the public eye, inside Russia and outside of Russia, who show more open-mindedness when it comes to Russian foreign policy objectives. For example, what's happened in Ukraine, what's happened in Syria. If we just have a look in Britain, it has been revealed in the last few weeks about the Institute for Statecraft, the Integrity Initiative, British government-funded projects which have been established to do exactly what I said just now, to denigrate Russia and to denigrate those people in the public eye who challenge the British and American narratives when it comes to Russia or Ukraine or Syria. So yes, these are very, very dark times. And when we see newspapers in Britain and America saying that RT, for example, is controversial or crosstalk is controversial, well, I always pose this question. Who defines what controversial is? And secondly, who applies the word controversial. Now, all you need to do is a bit of research and you will see that the people who define the word controversial in the context of RT, the people who apply the word controversial in the context of RT, have it in for RT. So they're not impartial whatsoever.
Yeah, right, exactly. You know, Mark, it's a very insidious marriage between the deep state and journalists that have abandoned the profession in the way that I understand being a journalist here. I mean, this is just a mechanism to shut down free speech at all costs, okay?
Yeah, absolutely, to support the official establishment narrative. And they claim that they have real journalists and editors doing what they call fact-checking, right? But the connections with the U.S. deep state are obvious. First of all, they're partnering. This is huge. Their NewsGuard is partnering with Microsoft on this. They are fighting to get this installed in schools, public libraries, universities. They want this mandatory on every mobile phone and computer sold in the United States. They want Facebook and Twitter to start using them as well. They've got a color-coded system, right?
We're red, okay?
Fox News and Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, the U.S. Propaganda Network are green. RT, CGTN, right? Those are red. They're bad. And they're rolling out a brand guard as well that goes out with this. And what it's doing is attempting to force companies to stop using advertising online that many alt media sources, like say Mint Press and others, rely on ad revenues in order to help generate funds on their paper thin budget. But there's all kinds of connections. First of all, the founders of NewsGuard are linked to all kinds of neocon think tanks like the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute, and on their list of advisors. For how this is set up. Who are the advisors telling NewsGuard what news is good and what is bad? Michael Hayden, the former director of the CIA and the NSA, both, right? You also have Richard Stengel on there, right? Just to show the bipartisanship of it. He was an Obama-era official. He was an undersecretary, I believe, in the State Department for the Obama administration. And he famously said, "Many people call me Obama's chief propagandist," and then he went on in a Council of Foreign Relations discussion, right, in front of cameras to say that he's all in favor of targeting propaganda, in those words, propaganda against the American people. And he's the one who's going to be advising NewsGuard on what's real news and what's not.
Do you mean, is this going to work? I mean, there's, when I was growing up, there was a nice saying, if you push the toothpaste out of the tube, you can't get it back in. Have publics been exposed to open sources on the internet well enough for these state-supported actors to start contracting it? I mean, what would be the reaction here? My attitude is that when I'm on Facebook, I can see what a fake story is, when it's a fake story, when someone puts it on, okay? You have an intuitive sense here, and I think most people that are interested in news have an intuitive sense. I think we have to trust the individual here. Is this form of censorship, is it going to destroy what we understand as the internet?
We know that media can fuel hatred more than actual acts, And I think this is a modern day racism when you declare a certain group of people simply non-eligible for a certain activity. Like there was racism against Russian athletes. They can't compete at the Olympic Games. You can't even speak Russian there. You can't show Russian flag even in the audience. The same story with the media. Let me quote what the French President Macron said last year about RT and Sputnik without referring to them by name. But he said, addressing the French journalists, "There are some people who imitate your speech, your manners, your formats, but they are not you. And we have to deal with all of that." So it's just amazing. He is basically saying that there are certain people posing as journalists, but because they object to him, they are not journalists. And this is the reason why French people showed such huge opposition to Macron. I think even the British, even the Germans don't understand this. They all expected that, yeah, well, there's protests to die down. Why they didn't die down? Because Macron doesn't learn anything, you know. Yeah. He divides people into friends and enemies, and enemies are dehumanized, you know. Enemies, they just imitate journalist formats. Enemies, you can meet them at the train station, as he says. You can meet at the train station successful people like me who did something in life, and you may meet absolute nobodies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is this kind of attitude that makes people angry drives them to the alternative media.
Obviously, and that's why they're in the streets. Marcus, let me go back to you in London. I would just take what Dima Babic had to say and kind of invert it here. In my lifetime, I think about, you know, before the internet, some really great journalists, great television journalists, great writers and all that. But today, they're just basically stenographers for power. I don't see a whole lot of quality journalism. It's always the reference is to power. I suppose that makes you rich and it makes you famous. You get celebrity. But they're just peddling a message here. So to criticize me because of where I work, you know, to invalidate that is exactly what Dima Babic is saying here. I mean, it's basically people that have that opinion invalidate journalism as a profession. Go ahead, Marcus in London.
Yes, let me be candid and I suppose brutally candid about these people in America and Britain who masquerade as journalists. They are not, of course, proper journalists, certainly not in our definition of what makes a journalist. It is my view that they fall into one or two categories, or perhaps both categories. The first category, I would describe them as ideologically driven foot soldiers of the American establishment and the British establishment. These people, Peter, genuinely believe in the necessity of Western global dominance.
Yeah.
They believe in that as much as we believe it is important for Russia to be a superpower.
Marcus, we're almost out of time. What's the second category? We're almost out of time. What's the second category you said?
Well, quite simply, money talks. Money makes the world go round. And certainly when it comes to the Institute for Statecraft, we now know many of these people...
Okay, it's the business model here. All right, I have to jump in here, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow and in London. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR. CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.